Everybody wants to be a part of the culture.
Until it's time to be diverse, equitable, and inclusive.
So we're having the uncomfortable conversations needed to spark the change.
Right here, right now.
We're your hosts, Ty Devereaux Lawson.
And I'm Simeon Coker.
And we say all the things you wouldn't.
Welcome back to the Mixed Company Podcast.
Okay, guys, we are back for another episode of Mixed Company Podcast. This time, as you know, it is Mixed Company Podcast presented to you by the Advertising Club of New York for the year of 2024. As we discussed in our last episode, Mixed Company and the Ad Club, we are partners for the year. And this collaboration aims to bring together the best of both worlds. The expertise, obviously, of the Advertising Club and the engaging content and humor of Mixed Company Podcast. As a part of this partnership, both organizations, we're going to be working really closely to create valuable content and relevant content for all of you that are listening. Each episode is going to consist of industry experts. We've got two really dope ones here with us today, and thought leaders that we're going to invite to share their insights and their experiences on various topics related to all things advertising. One thing you must know, we encourage you all to join as members of the Advertising Club and their mission to educate, celebrate, and empower our community of over 6,000 agency marketing, media, and communications professionals by simply going to theadvertisingclub.org. Tons of great stuff. They've got their fellowship, they've got internship programs, and all kinds of great things. So hopefully we get to see you on this side of the Ad Club. If not, definitely listen to this episode as we get into it. Simeon, how you doing today?
I am doing well. It's March now.
It's March. We're officially March, and we are at this really amazing space, which is going to allow me to introduce our wonderful and esteemed guest today. We're at that intersection between Black History Month and Women's History Month when it's all things culture. And so our conversation today is really going to be on the state of the state of the state of DE&I. And to join us for this conversation, because it is March and we are nearing the end of Q1 already, we have the fantabulous Micheline Grace Lewis, who is the Chief People Officer of DDB. Hey, Micheline.
Hey.
How are you? Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you as well.
Yeah.
And we also have Tape Ajala, Global Head of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion over at Ogilvy, holding it down. Tape, long time no see, but excited to see you. How's it going?
Hey, long time no see. It's you know, holding it down.
That's it. That's all you can do, especially in March, right?
Right. Women March already, yes.
Well, happy early International Women's Day to you both. Happy belated Black History Month to you both. And my hope is that we get to have a really fulfilling conversation about diversity, equity, and inclusion. But before we dive in there, I would love to get to know you both a little bit and introduce you to the audience. And so, Micheline, if you don't mind, can you tell us a little bit about your career? How did you make it to the top of the top of the top of the people officers over at DDB? Tell us a little bit about your story.
So there's actually someone over me who's in the global world. Let's start there, but I got North America.
The top of the top for the North America.
There you go. I got North America. How did I make it there? So I think I have a very varied background, right? So I like to say that I'm, you know, industry fluid. So before I joined DDB, I was actually Chief People Officer for Mother. And so I had not been in kind of advertising really prior to Mother. I have, no matter where I've been, I've had marketing as one of the disciplines that I have partnered as an HR partner. So before Mother, I was actually with JP Morgan Chase. I see Tafe's face. So in terms of, you know, just, you know, vibes of what you expect to get, but really not so different. And I was on the Chase side of the business, so the consumer side of the business. I never worked in the IB or the private bank, investment bank, excuse me, or the private bank. I was always on the Chase side, working with the consumer bank, you know, the branches, the business bankers, I had the Chase marketing team who were fantastic. So a lot of people came out of agency on that Chase marketing team. I had the data and analytics team, et cetera. And that was really, that was a really wonderful, great experience. Better than actually I thought it was going to be director. I think people are like, ooh, big, they actually, it was pretty good. Part of that, I was actually with EY, Ernst & Young, as a consultant in their people advisory service. And I have a little bit of an expertise in HR M&A, mergers and acquisition. So I worked with EY on a big merger project. But first and foremost in my life, I'm a mother. And I've got two beautiful kids who are now teenagers. And a consultant life took me away from them far too much. And so when I landed at JP Morgan Chase, before JP Morgan Chase, or before EY, I was actually with eBay. And I was at eBay Enterprise Marketing Solutions. Once again, the marketing solutions brands on eBay Enterprise. And this was before the eBay and PayPal split. And then I actually worked on the eBay and PayPal split and then the Go Forward company set up. And I loved that. It was a lot of great people, a lot of great work. I probably would have stayed if not for our division being sold. And that's when I, and then, but through that work, I picked up M&A experience and that's how EY find me. So just a little bit about my background there. Diversified.
I love that.
Yeah.
You've seen some things.
I literally in my head, I'm singing been around the world. And like, that's like, your career has literally taken you around the world. And so now you're at DDB, you are leading, you are leading the people function for North America. Yeah. And I know for a fact, you named some really heavy players that have also played in the conversation of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so we're going to look forward to hearing your thoughts about what things look like for us on the marketing side, advertising side today. So thank you. Tabe, you and I go way back, like way, way back, like babies with pacifiers. Shout out to ODB. And for those that have not known you, as long as I've known you and had the opportunity to work with you and partner with you over the years, tell folks how you got here to lead, to be the global head of diversity, equity, and inclusion at Ogilvy.
Thank you so much. I laugh because we have similar backgrounds, Micheline. We do. So the investment banking piece is actually where I started my career. So my background is in operations, it's in data systems. So I laugh because it's also not traditional advertising. And then I moved into the advertising space and I've been there for the last 10 years. But again, didn't start with D&I, started within kind of operations and building out an operations function in London, also in Asia. So I lived in Singapore, India, and Japan for the best part of 2 years, came back to the US, where I've been now for 7 years out of the 10, 7 years. And my career is really non-traditional. Right. I think it's really important to have something else that helps inform kind of the D&I path. And for me, it's like understanding how businesses work. So I've been client side as well, partnering with the Googles, the T-Mobiles of the world, Verizon, and so on and so forth. And then, you know, worked with Kai for a few years, which was amazing and awesome. Again, building out D&I and what was, I believe, the first of its kind for WPP. I think it was. I think our team was one of the first D&I functions for WPP. So WPP is what it is now from an inclusion standpoint because of the likes of Kai, myself, Judy Jackson, and others. And then, you know, after building for a few years, you kind of want to go from the parents, aka WPP, in-house, a little bit more insular. So I think that's what drove the transition, the successful transition from WPP, still within the family, but to Ogilvy, because I saw the appetite that they just needed something different. And I always say, I'm not traditional. I am not your classic, you know, chief people officer type role. I didn't, like, my background isn't in HR at all. It's in how businesses operate, how individuals feel, how they function, the numbers, what the numbers tell us and how we act on the numbers. But aside from that, I also love the fact that both of us are mothers. I'm a new mom. So yeah, I'm a new mom. God, saying that out loud is scary. With a nearly 1 year old. My daughter is nearly one. So I'm in that fog of getting back into the workspace and understanding kind of who I am and what the business now offers and what I then offer to the business, because I now have a new lens into, you know, building a space for my child to grow and to feel comfortable in a world where they feel like they can be who they are. So the purpose has changed, but that's kind of a little bit into my background, my history. And of course, I'm British. I just lived in the US. My accent apparently has never left me and will never leave me, hopefully. and I'm Nigerian by, you know, parents, roots and everything about me, because I, you know, I'm a proud Nigerian and everyone's met a proud Nigerian. So I'm one of those.
Amazing.
You know,
as the creative on the call, and like, there are a lot of adults in the room who actually like do really big, important things. So welcome. But, I kind of want to kick the conversation off and like jump right in, because in 2020, we all saw what happened. We all saw the conversation around DEI sort of take a peak, if you will. And now we're in 2024. There were a lot of promises that were made back then. We can say a lot of those promises were broken. And so for the people who are listening, who probably have a really strong critique of DEI, how do you see the conversation sort of evolving from what was happening in 2020 to where we are right now? Like, how should the people who feel the effects of the work that you guys do be talking about DEI?
I believe that there was, especially in the wake of George Floyd's murder, right? There was this watershed moment that happened, certainly across the US and not across the world. And people had a real, a real awakening. But then there were a lot of these kumbaya moments, right? Mm. And there was a lot of, you know, we were masked in COVID, and there was a lot of emotion. There was a lot of white guilt, to be quite honest, right? That kind of came out, you know, I'm going to go out and march in my mask, which, you know, great, appreciate it. However, remember saying, I would rather you challenge this leader who is consistently saying something biased and not leaving it just to me. That's how I'd like you to partner with me. You and your children can stay inside and, you know, and be safe if you don't want to march. That's how I'd like you to see you show up in this organization. That was harder. That was a harder, you know, I'd rather go out and march than to stand up. And I think that now you can see that there's, listen, around the world, and certainly in this US, there is this, you know, 180. I feel like we're back behind. You know, like some of the stuff that, like, I mean, listen, Donald Trump had us in a place that was, scary.
We are literally repeating 2020 is what you're saying, but also what's on the news right now.
What's on the news right now, what's coming up. I mean, I remember being at a dinner with, I've got Italian godparents, and I'm Jamaican. Let me just own that, because you guys are Nigerian. I'm Jamaican, both sides.
Proud. Niger, Jamaican, like cross intersectionality happening on this call. Simeon, you are representing with your people.
I know. I'm the Nigerian and Jamaican, so yes.
Look at that. So I have Italian godparents, and I was at their home for an occasion. And one of their nephews was saying, you know, after Donald Trump made that comment with the reporter who was disabled, and he's like, there's no way anyone will vote for him now. There's just no way. Once people see that, there's just no way. And then it was like, no, you know, and he's gone so much further, right? Yes. And then Elon Musk, I mean, just the rhetoric that is just so free flowing everywhere. So yes, that's where we are. And I believe as an industry, we have a responsibility, because we are, the advertising's everywhere, right? We have a responsibility, but the conversations that happen, you know, we don't want it to be performative, right? We want it to be real.
I wonder if we've gone from scrutinizing like our advertisers to, hey, it is what it is. Because I remember for the last, let's say the last 6 years, 2024. So 2028, people cared, right? 2020, people vocally cared. You saw the highest amount of D&I roles open in history all over the world. I don't want to look at the numbers of where we are today, because I'm sure that number has reduced significantly. You also had an increased level of accountability and transparency from businesses, because employees were asking that. Are employees still asking? So it's a two-sided coin. And I always say this to everyone, it's you have to be just as responsible for wanting change, but you also have to hold people who have power to make the change responsible and accountable. So have we shifted back as well as individuals because we don't feel like businesses are that invested? So some businesses are invested, some aren't. We will always know that. But there's this fear, there's this lingering fear. And similar to your question, I sit on both sides. Like, I'm the person who's hoping that no one has forgotten the commitments they made in 2020, plus the black boxes and the lights. And then I'm also the person who's in a position of power to make change in partnership, though, right? It's not individualistic, it's in partnership. Mm-hmm. And I don't hear as much level of accountability and heightened scrutiny to our advertising partners as I saw in 2020, whereas that's now my role. And I'm still the champion, I'm still advocating, and I'm still scrutinizing, but I don't hear it from colleagues and others. And I wonder what shifted.
I definitely have perspective on that. And I think you both bring up really interesting points. And Micheline, don't think I didn't catch that shade talking about marching in masks, but there's something you could do here at the job. I was like, shade, no shade. I think you both bring up really important pieces of the conversation about performance and performative inclusion. And if nothing else, I believe that the biggest benefit that we had to the 2020 awakening was that we got to see in real life the life cycle of DE&I engagement. And part of that engagement is the, oh my gosh, I had no idea that people actually experienced that. We have to do something, to, oh my gosh, this is actually really hard to do something, to, you know what, this is really heavy, I could really just use a laugh right now, to, oh shoot, wait, there are other priorities, let me go catch up on those things. And it's like, well, where is everybody? And so, Tape, I think that might be what you are experiencing. That's definitely something that I was experiencing in my role as an inclusion leader, and also on the backside of the deprioritization of inclusion in certain organizations. And so what I think is happening is that we recognize, just everyone now knows just how heavy it is, and just how imperfect it is, and just how messy being inclusive can be. It's actually, it probably is far messier than just being overtly or in a masked way, unequitable or inequitable in certain organizations. And so I think a lot of people buckled under that pressure. One of the things that I also think contributes to it, and this is neither good nor bad, but in a recent article in Ad Age by Kai D. Wright, shout out to Kai, there's so many Kais in the industry right now, like I never know who's talking to me anymore. But Kai wrote an article that says DE&I in advertising, why real progress has been made. And he talks about how, you know, although the industry in 2023 was at its an all-time high of Black people in the industry, of diversity in the industry, but largely of Black professionals in the marketing industry, he noticed that after tracking and auditing a lot of the data for over the last 20 years, that DEI progress often loses momentum without that public pressure and government mandates. And you bring up really important points, because over the last 2 years, and I don't need to go through and name them, we all know the different, you know, Supreme Court decisions that have come down, a lot of the lawsuits that have come out, and all of these things happen after a time of revolution. But that can be discouraging to folks who candidly might have been benefiting already from the pre-2020 corporate existence or workplace existence, where it's like, you know, maybe there's a silent recession happening, there's inflation happening, business is dropping, and so maybe we need to reprioritize in DE&I because no one is, you know, watching rewatching George Floyd candidly on social media and experiencing all of that on social media and in their face and being confined to their homes on a basically 24-hour level. When it's not in people's face, it's not their priority. And so I feel like that might be what you're experiencing. But,
you know, something really important that was said, that a couple of things, but there was, it was a commitment, right? These commitments were made, right? Mm-hmm. And then they became too heavy.
Yep.
And it was like, this is a lot. And then we're going to track it. And then we made commitments with our partners who are our clients about the things we were going to do, people that we were going to employ on our sets and our productions and our whatever, you know, and all these things. And then there became this like, do we have to talk about this anymore? And then what I saw was things, you know, you talk about, do people in the business, and because also really important that you said, you come from the operations side, you come from the business side, right?
Yeah.
When you have that business lens, right? It's like, that's why the commitments were made, because they didn't want to impact, right, their bottom line by not doing it. What I saw candidly was that there was like, oh, we didn't make this last quarter of what we did. We didn't make our commitments. You know, well, we really tried. Did we try?
How did we try?
And then who is challenging it? Because if I'm challenging it, even though I said you made a business commitment, I'm still HR, checking a box, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a Black woman, checking a box, right? Mm-hmm. Where is the allyship?
Right,
in asking those questions of the commitments we made. And I was thoroughly discouraged to see commitments so easily pushed aside. We really don't have, we should talk about them in all the meetings. We're not going to talk about
the bottom line. The bottom line. You know, we have numbers to make. Sorry to cut you off, but it just, it triggered. I use that word heavy.
Were you triggered?
I was, because I've seen articles. You've read all the things, and, you know, especially with the Elons of the world and people who are heavy against D&I, you see them saying things like D&I is dead. And like, there are people they influence, right? They influence other leaders. They influence people who run organizations who actually have to be accountable to their employees. So things like, oh, but, you know, we didn't make our bottom line. Okay, but you could have made your bottom line, because statistics prove that if you're more inclusive in thought, you're more inclusive of the suppliers you hire and partner with, your bottom line increases. You have employees who are more engaged, not disengaged. It's a ripple effect of only success. So if you don't do one thing that you committed to, the reason you're not succeeding and not hitting your bottom line is because you actually aren't doing the things your employees have told you are required to keep them engaged, to make them feel like they're invested in. And ultimately, we also know that if you invest in women, if you invest in people of color, you get diversity of thought, better outcomes. So back to you, that triggered just the, you know, the bottom line conversation around they should have.
Make a business decision, or we have to make a DEI decision, as opposed to recognizing that those things literally should be conflated. The question that I have for you both, though, right, because part of what we started this show in an really to vent, so that we weren't all our money at happy hour venting to ourselves. It was just a healthier opportunity. But I wonder, between the two of you, right, like, we know what the situation is. We know that policies and actual laws are being rolled back as it pertains to inclusive minded engagement. And so, Ms. Lean, I'd love to start with you and then go over to Tape. But how do you both, in your positions of leadership and influence, encourage the people that you work directly with and those that maybe not directly but are in your sphere? How do you encourage them to either prepare themselves or to work more effectively to continue progress, knowing what we know right now about the way the world, the country, the city, the industry is?
So, you know, being in a people function, right? So an HR function, right? I had an old assistant who said to me, oh, a Black woman chief people officer, you're not unique in advertising, right? Mm-hmm. You know, And I know, Tape, you said, there was all these DEI roles, and we wonder how many they've been rolled back. But how many people were put into DEI roles because of the color of their skin, but not any real interest, drive, accountability for, I will, and edit this out if this is not allowed to say, I'll get sued.
You could say it here as long as you have your job, because you have a lawn and kids to take care of.
But what I'll say is that, they, like at JP Morgan Chase, they put a business leader who was a Black man in the D&I role. He is the same Black man on the Florida Board of Governors who just rolled back all of the D&I.
Wow.
That is factual.
Yeah.
That's not an opinion.
That is
No,
factual.
had nothing to edit. That's real.
And I remember when some of the things were being rolled out, I was like, that's what we're doing. And when this came, a former colleague actually texted me in the article, and she goes, recognize a name? And she goes, you said, I said, yes, I did. It was high level performative, but like where, and then, but where's the accountability for the people who, once again, are making the decisions, making the business, making the money? That's one piece. The other piece is this, something that Tappy said, being a mother and being, and having deep auntie vibes, talked about that, right? I'm not done, but I'm doing the part that I can. But generationally, I need the people behind me to get in the game. And not just in people functions. I need people in the business to get in the game, and I need allies. We have a lot of Gen Z who talked about social responsibility and equity. Are you still asking those questions? Are you still demanding it in the same way? Or are you, do you have fatigue? Or are you just done, right? Because I can have this seat at the table, and I will use my seat at the table. I will not just be it, I will use it. But what are you doing behind it? And that's what I'm encouraging to say, okay, how are you going to be a part of the solution now, not just me? And I think that's a little bit kind of where I go.
What does that look like for you? And I think, part of this conversation, thinking about culture right now. So after 2020 and all of the commitments, there were also mass layoffs. And so I think there's a little bit of fear, like balled up into the people who are some of the people who were the loudest in 2020 and 2021 and 2022. Because like, okay, the great resignation is over. People got bills, and you don't know if you'll be able to find another job. What does that look like practically for someone has that fire inside and they want to be a part of the solution, but they're also worried about, okay, if I'm loud, I'll probably be the first one to go.
And that's a hard balance. That's the truth. Go, Tabe, please go.
And I think that happens all the time. I don't think there's any employee that doesn't necessarily have a passion project or something in their head that they want to do. That's going to change and propel a business. So I challenge our employees. I'm always they, there's always going to be a problem. There's always going to be something that they are not happy with. And for the last few years, I've said, what's the solution? I don't, one of my mentors always told me, ask, do you want me to solve this? Or do you intend to have me listen to your possible solutions? And I've taken that everywhere, and we've managed to build several programs because I've asked our employees, what is the soul for you? So you see a gap for this group of people, whether it's neurodiverse employees, whether it's mothers, whether it's people with disability, what's the soul? And then you partner with them so that the voice and the loudness is channeled into something tangible for the business. And again, I'm thinking my ops hat. Everyone wants to solve a problem, but they don't necessarily have the right skill set to solve it. However, if you partner with a manager, a senior exec, someone in the business that cares, not everyone cares, right? That's important. Find someone in the business that cares enough and just, I won't call it vent, but propose your idea. I doubt you will have a leader say, oh, absolutely not. If you're solving a gap, we have within the business. And I think that's what keeps you safe in an organization, being part of something that they can't get rid of, something they've invested in. You know, it's versus, hey, business, we have all these 20 problems, go fix it. Right. Mm-hmm. There's only, you know, the people team's only big enough. The operation team's only big enough. We need employees to get behind what they want solved, because it takes two. I always say it takes leadership and it takes the doers to create that solve.
I'll help you build your framework. I will help you get it to the right ear. But what's the solution? I also say, what can we solve today? Mm-hmm. What impact can we make today? What is our desire long term? What is our path there? Because yes, we want this. What are the steps that get us there along the way? And let's talk about that together. And then what's your part in that? Because, you know, deep auntie vibes, I'm still not here to do the work for you. It's in partnership.
That just reminds me of something that we used to say when we started the podcast, specifically around issues that require DEI solutions within advertising, that we are the problem solvers. Like, this is why clients hire us, to come in and solve these problems and utilize culture and utilize those cultural signals to solve the problems. And so kind of what I'm hearing is, if you're able to solve this problem within your own organization, that solution could possibly be packaged up and given or sold, because we are here to make money, sold to a client to basically solve something that's happening within their space, because it's not unique to us. I think we are in a unique business, but the things that we're experiencing, they're also experiencing in finance, they're also experiencing at a CPG company. And so I think there is an opportunity for the people who are noticing or seeing these problems within an organization to start coming up with solutions that could then be packaged up and proposed to clients, since we are, you know, the leaders in culture and we create it, in quotation marks.
Exactly that. And we've seen an increase in things like intercultural marketing, right? Mm-hmm. That's been a big, we just launched ours internally, but that again, didn't come from the D&I team. That came from our strategist. That came from, again, in partnership, right? It's everything is in partnership. What's the need? What's the solution? And how do we sell that back into our clients? Because our clients are asking for it. They just needed it packaged so it was digestible and they understood what was being, what the service they were receiving was. But yeah, that's ultimately how we think about it, both from a business lens and also from an employee lens. Is there's something you're trying to solve for. There's a way you package it. The business can help you. And then you deliver it to clients and everyone wins and the bottom line isn't a thing.
Yeah.
There's the allyship in that, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, mm-hmm. I had said, maybe not to always the promotion of my career, are you asking me to solve your racism? Mm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. let's.
Ooh, I felt that one.
No, so it's, I'm glad that you said that. Because I was actually going to come back to you, Micheline. One of the things that I think is really great about the conversations we've always had on this platform and why the Advertising Club of New York has, you know, decided to partner with us this year, is that we really focus on uncovering the things that other people don't say. Like, saying mm-hmm. the things nobody else says in mixed company. And your question just now, like, are you asking me to solve your racism? Do you recognize that I'm not supposed to be here to do this on my own? You know, questions that aren't always asked out loud. And so I wonder, from the both of you, recognizing the depths of how you engage in this work, Micheline, especially you from an HR perspective, because let's, you know, we're getting comfortable now. So I can say the thing that's not always said, but the reality is a lot of people look at HR and the people function as the ops, if you will, right? As the people that are going to run tell that or opponents or however you feel about HR. It's not always positive, but you're saying real things on this show today. And so I wonder, what are the other elements of conversation that might be missing from diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging right now? And let's put them out on the table. What should we be saying? What should we be talking about and making them more real than nuanced?
That's such a big one. as many strides as advertising has made, it is still very much a white male Eurocentric industry. Not that others aren't, but especially at a leadership level. And even the creative space, or especially I think in the creative space, there comes a time that I've seen with young creatives where if they don't feel, even if they feel the allyship, if they don't feel like the notes of culture are picked up, if they don't feel like, you know, we talk about D&I, but belonging is something that's super important. And the fatigue in a creative space of not belonging, so therefore your creative ideas are not met with the same enthusiasm or understanding, or, you know, and I do believe that there are many allies who see, like, you know, we're not just asking you to be on this client call because, you know, we need another brown face in the box, but it still feels that way, right? Mm-hmm. Or I think from an HR perspective, speaking to clients, you know, about D&I, when really what you should be able to speak to D&I in your own organization without having the brown HR person be the one who is representative. I firmly believe that it's gotta be all across the business. And I see it in every slide, it's all across, but it's always underneath. But then show me how it's going up. You just told me it's underneath. Show me then the links throughout what that actually is. And that's how HR can challenge it. I always say it cannot be, and I've said this probably 7 times at least now, cannot be an HR checkbox. Check, we talked D&I. It's gotta be in the business, not just in the slices. It's all through all that we do. How are you doing it in all that you do? How are you, white European male leader, asking those questions and I know it's hard because you feel like maybe it's not your space, but how are you learning to ask those questions? How are you leaning in to make those challenges and not just looking for me or a member of my team to say,
there's a level of vulnerability.
Okay, I want to pivot the question for you because I actually want you to answer differently. I want you to answer something a little bit more specific because you are a head of inclusion. Mm-hmm. And what Micheline was just talking about in terms of like other people saying, you got to do the work of the work that you've done, of the programming that you've put together, of the strategies that you've had in place, where should people look to find progress? Because I think people are going to say all the time, I don't see it. I don't see the growth. I don't see this. And it's like, check my emails. I need you to look at my timesheet. I need you to understand I've been hustling real hard, Rick Ross, right? So like, where are those places? Because it's not going to be, we're not going to boil the ocean, but where are those places where people should consider the potential that progress is actually being made due to the work of leads like yourself who are fully functionally tasked with DEI work?
That's a great question, by the way. A little bit challenging, but here is what I think based off of the work I do. I think one, look at your global offices and look at the global perspective. I say this intentionally because oftentimes if you're stuck in a location, you think there is no progress happening in that location because that is all you know, right? Mm-hmm. That is all you know every day, Monday through to Friday. But oftentimes, you know, I may reach out to Japan or I might reach out to our APAC office and I'm like, you managed to get one of our clients to make customized items for women for International Women's Day. That would have never happened 5-10 years ago. Right. So I always encourage people to tap into their global counterparts to see what's happening in their location from a knowledge sharing standpoint. So that's one, just from a quick, easy tap. The other thing is sometimes look outside of the thing you want to have changed. And I'll explain. Sometimes people are looking for more Black women. As an example, I want more Black women in this office. But are there more women overall in the history of advertising in the organization? Yes or no? That's a shift. And to your point, Kai, we're not going to boil the ocean overnight. Like, we're not going to, but we are going to make incremental changes. So look at the incremental changes. What is your leadership makeup? Years ago, most of the leadership in advertising was all men. For us at Ogilvy, we're 50% women. And like, that was never the case up until a few years ago. So it's like, look at the high level, but also try and look at the things that may not necessarily impact you in the immediate term, but it does in the long term. The more women you have in leadership, as an example, they're going to invest in more women-led programs. They're going to have, you're going to have more sponsors. You're going to have people who are invested in your career progression. So that's just like one of two things, right? Looking at it from a global lens, because that's to me is easy. It makes you feel good that there are others that are doing something that you can bring into your world and your region. The other thing I say from an advertising standpoint is look at the work being produced. That's a lot. That's not an overnight thing. That's a long-term part of the job that we do. These conversations that we have with leaders every day, challenging them every day. No one hears that beyond you and that leader. But I've had in the last 6-7 years, I've had leaders say, hey, I did have three, let's say, white men in offer process. Like, I wanted to put an offer out to them, but then you had a conversation with me, you asked me to think differently and to not pick the same people I'm comfortable picking and to challenge myself. No one's hearing that. I don't need praise for that. But that is years in the making. So now every time that leader is through the interview process, they're being fairer. We've implemented things like 50% slates. So 50% of the people you put forward have to be people of color. Your general employee at a manager level probably doesn't know that, but the directors, the exec. So Kai, I hope that answered your question, but it's at the high level, at the low level, globally, in pockets, you will find things like vendors come in. When did we had Caribbean vendors in the office? That wasn't happening back in the day. We had African vendors, Mexican vendors. We are celebrating culture in a way where we never would have done in the last 5-10 years.
Yeah.
Now
and
we
like
are.
The transparency. Yes.
It's
yes.
The transparency. It's yeah. The uncomfortable. I'm sure like we would have had uncomfortable leaders in the past who's like, I don't really want to do that. And now they have partners who are challenging them, holding them accountable and saying, hey, we want people to feel like they belong. So let's celebrate them in ways where they feel like they belong in increments. We have deeper levels of work to do. There's the equity piece and all the work, but there are things we can do in the immediate term that make people feel like they belong, that's visible. You just have to go looking for it. And then the classic thing we've started doing is updates every quarter. Hey, here's all the things that's been happening across the world. In case you didn't know, here's how you can get involved in case you weren't aware. Because oftentimes, you know, not everyone reads their emails. So you have to find ways to connect.
Kai's like, I know what people read their emails. Yeah, the systemic piece is absolutely true. And the global pivot, because we all feel like, you know, Advertising Club of New York, we're in New York. We feel it differently than even our brothers and sisters in the UK, or, you know, differently, certainly in even Nigeria. But there is a bias that happens in different ways, and diversity conversations happen in different ways, certainly in India and Asia. So the system, New York to Chicago, let's be real, like, but the way, or New York to San Francisco, we had this okay. conversation, right?
LA,
okay,
Atlanta. The difference is
different. So, but we see, so I love that. It's like open the view of, like, you know, of what's happening all over, and we cannot boil the ocean. I keep trying.
I don't want to use that as an excuse, because I'm looking at a comment you made, Micheline, and you know, we were talking about what are some things that we need to focus on, and so neurodiversity is super important, and that is becoming point and topic. Supplier diversity, another way to look at inclusion outside of just who you're hiring for full time work in terms of vendors, partners, contractors, freelancers, etc.
LGBTQ plus
outside of the month of June. However, you said something that for me is like, it's the thing that I struggled with as an inclusion leader. And it's this concept that like more, it's DEIB math, that's what I titled it as. And this concept that like more diversity in one area, just because we are upping our supplier diversity or we're focusing on neurodiversity and accessibility and ensuring that we're creating physical and unseen and environments that are safe for unseen disabilities doesn't mean that we should take our eye off the ball for the other areas. And for me, I read that personally as like, as you know, when we talk about race and ethnicity in the workplace, because oftentimes that's what happens. We're not focusing on this area because we're focusing on that area. So from your perspective, would love to know, like, I'd love for you to talk more about that, or to stress, or to have a call to action for folks about like not decreasing diversity in one area because all of a sudden you're shifting in another area. Your thoughts.
My thoughts are exactly that, which is that, or like, yes, we highlight during Black History Month, shortest month of the year. Then we get to Women's History Month, and like, I'm still a woman and I'm still Black in this next month. And, you know, but it can't just be these months that we're having these discussions about it. You know, one of the leaders at JP Morgan Chase, like a big business leader, I was in a meeting with him, and someone was like, oh, well, we, you know, we have flags, you know, for June and the branches. And he was like, great, you want to do it outside of June? And I looked at him, and this was a white man. Blue eyes. And let me tell you, I still exchange holiday cards with him because I have so much respect for him.
Yeah. I love that.
Right? Because like he and I was like, and I didn't have to say a thing. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I love that. But it's like, can you have these conversations consistently? Mm-hmm. Can you make, you know, it's not just this month. Like, yes, this is a moment in time when we focus on it, but what are you doing? One does not negate the other. If Hispanics are up, it doesn't mean that Blacks have to be down. You know, if women are up, like, and you don't have to say things like, I'm only going to hire a Latino team. Mm-hmm. So don't show me anything else. Because then people feel like you only hired them because they are, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's like, are you having the diverse candidate slate? Mm-hmm. Are you giving everybody the real chance? Are you looking at that work and not saying, oh, they use too much color, right? Mm-hmm. Like, are you you're discounting them? Are you having these conversations equally? And are you doing it all the time? Are you inviting people who, yes, are representational into a safe space to share? And are you accepting them during that safe space time? And once again, it doesn't have to be their assigned month.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say that if everything that Micheline is saying right now is making you uncomfortable, you should do some self-interrogation. I think because that's everything that you're talking about is the way that it should be. And I also think that it started to shift into that direction in the last couple of years, and it shifted a little too hard for some people, which is why there's so much pushback right now. But I think that what you're saying, if it is making someone uncomfortable, like that's a sign to do some self-interrogation, and that's how you get better, right? Because if you're feeling a little bit uncomfortable, then you know that there's something that you need to work on, because everything that we're talking about, we had Lisa Schomburg on a couple of weeks ago, and we're talking about those soft skills that become the power skills, right? Like being able to sort of mitigate your own biases so that you're able to get to a better place. And I think that's the hard part, because you can do what you do and Tape could do what she does, but ultimately like people need to shift and grow and evolve on their own in order for the culture to get better as a whole.
Yeah, like lead by example, right? We can accept a cultural competency gap, right? That's what I called it, because I think there's always a cultural competency gap anywhere and with people. But then what are you doing to close that gap, right? Mm-hmm. Are you ensuring that we have inclusive policies? Are you, to Kai's point, making sure that you're the person leading the supply diversity charge, right? Mm-hmm. Versus, hey, D&I, hey, people team, hey, whatever the team functionality is, like how are you leading as an exec or as a manager, as a director in an industry that, you know, is predominantly white? Let's be honest, is an industry that's predominantly white. How are you making the changes? And it's not about making anyone feel excluded. It's knowing that there's a marginalized group of people that were never included. Mm-hmm. So we have a long way to go to move them closer in. But how are you doing that as a leader? And to your point, I love what you said, Tim, and it's making sure that if this is making you uncomfortable, then look within and make sure you're doing the work to close that gap. Yeah. Finding a policy, finding a project, finding someone to mentor, do the work. And yeah. Don't rely on just the people tasked at a high level to do the work, because it actually takes a whole business, and it shouldn't be predominantly women or Black women who often are in these roles to make the change, because we can't and we won't be successful in it if we don't have the support and the allyship of everyone else.
I actually love the way that you said it more maturely than I've said it in my past, to be quite honest. I remember in the wake of George Floyd, do you remember there were all these check in on your Black friends, right? And you got calls from people you have heard
calling
from in
me.
Years, years,
stop
right?
Calling me.
And then there was
do not disturb. Do not disturb.
And then there were some people. I was like, wait, you actively undermine my career. Why are you checking in?
Why are you checking?
I remember.
My favorite were the apology emails. I was getting apology emails and DMs. Child, listen, I still go back and read them every once in a while.
Have they checked in since?
We've reinvigorated relationships, but baby, those DMs,
yes.
Stop calling me.
Yeah. Well, I kind of said not as nicely as Simeon said, you need to check in with yourself and your behavior. And I actually said in a meeting, a team meeting, I said, if you want to say that you're not racist because I'm your friend, I'm going to tell you to, I'm not your card. I'm not a racist card. You all need to look at your behavior, because we all have unconscious bias, all of us. And you need to self-interrogate. I am not your, I'm not a racist card because I'm your friend, because we're on this team.
Yeah.
And after I called my boss. I was like, I think it just limited my career.
but here we are a whole 4 years later and you have not. And so that's good. You both said some amazing things, and we are at time. And so I just want to start to close out. But A, thanking you both for your candor. Yeah. Thank you for the therapy that has been done on this call. Okay. And Beyonce's second year of Renaissance Revolution. I think that we are moving the needle in terms of conversation. And I really just appreciate the honesty, the candor, the participation, and the good auntie tea. It was lots of really good auntie tea being spilled here. So thank you for that.
Yeah, this is fun.
Absolutely. So I am going to, we'll close out. First of all, thank you to the Advertising Club for allowing this conversation, or for welcoming this conversation rather, to their platform. Thank you to Tape and Micheline for joining us. As you may or may not know, you can find us, our podcast, Mixed Company Podcast, on all of the places that you get a podcast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, etc. You can follow us on all the social media channels. And also, if you dare to do some work and some digging, and you'd like to connect with these lovely people here, there's a whole platform called LinkedIn, which everybody has access to, and you can find more about Tape and Micheline there. Simeon, as always, great conversation. And for you all, we'll be back another day with another episode of the Advertising Club of New York presents Mixed Company Podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.